Boyd. Up next on Think, the incredibly complicated, finely tuned global machine that makes the year-round abundance of American supermarkets seem unremarkable. We'll spend this hour with writer Benjamin Lohr, whose new book takes us behind the scenes of the grocery business, from the invention of the supermarket to the production, distribution, and management of tens of thousands of perishable items. We'll hear why long-haul truckers can no longer count on a comfortable living, about abuses in the seafood industry and why boycotts may not be effective, and about why taste and quality are low priorities when grocery managers decide what to stock. Our conversation starts after a short break. Lots of businesses and institutions have had the wind knocked out of them by the pandemic. We're sending kids to school masked up like miniature heart surgeons, if we're sending them at all. Maybe you haven't been to your physical workplace or a movie or even an indoor party since March. But you know what has adapted really well to the way things are? Grocery stores. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you can ignore the face masks and just look at the shelves and display cases, the offerings are as abundant as ever. A rainbow of fruits and vegetables, fresh meat and dairy. And with the exception of the early days when we were all sort of panic buying, more than enough canned goods and toilet paper. Even a basic modern supermarket keeps more than 30,000 different products in stock, in season, and beautifully merchandised on any given day, which, if you think about it, is a logistical triumph that we take for granted. But as author Benjamin Lohr has learned, this food fantasy is maintained by many thousands of essential workers toiling behind the scenes, often with an unpredictable work schedule for a small paycheck. Lohr's new book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Ben, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
You see the grocery business as a business of desire, which is a really interesting way to look at it because I think most of us think of food as a necessary item, something we enjoy, but ultimately a thing we buy to stay alive.
Yes, I think grocery is this great reflection of the self in retail in general. And it's something that I didn't quite realize walking into the book. It's definitely not what attracted me to it. But more and more seeing how food has shifted from, you know, when I was growing up, you'd go to the supermarket, you'd just be shopping for food. And it was mostly about diet and nutrition, to something that people use to express just about every conceivable aspect of their personality, from connection to their ancestors, to their kin, to the fact that they have their own unique colon biota, to the fact that, they want to manifest health and ecological virtue, right? You could go all down the lines of the ways that we exist. And that's really reflected in our food. And then our supermarkets reflect that back to us.
And for a certain kind of wealthy person who wouldn't dream of wearing a flashy gold watch or driving a really ridiculously expensive car, there is a way to sort of convey status based on what we buy at the grocery store.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's really interesting. That's always been attached to food. When I was researching the book, I came across something called the anti-supper. I don't even think it's in the book, but it was this Victorian era practice where if you were really rich, you would entertain your guests by putting out a sumptuous banquet for them and letting them in to observe the banquet, and then in front of them, ripping it off the table, throwing it all away, and putting in even further like extravagant banquet in front of them, just to demonstrate through food that you were, you know, this like hyper wealthy, high status person. So that's always been attached to it. But I think the ways that we manifest that, it have become more subtle, right? No one wants to that type of excess and materialism and pure material objects like a Rolex fit, like you were saying. They're gaudy now. So we need these other subtler ways to flex our status, and food, which is, you know, ephemeral, it disappears right after you eat it, and you're kind of forced into it. So it's not something that's ostentatious, right? We all have to eat. Provides a really great platform for displaying that type of flex.
So grocery stores have changed a lot since I was a kid, but I've always known them to be fully stocked any time of day, any day of the week. You write that you spent a summer doing research in Kenya, and when you came back, the thing you could not get over was the sight of an American supermarket. What did you notice for the first time?
Yeah, I think, this was probably in parallel to what a lot of us went through with the pandemic, in that it was a chance for me to see this institution that had grown banal, boring, and a chore with completely new eyes. So that summer I went away, lived with no running water, no electricity. I was part of a research team that was studying blue monkeys in the jungle. And so, after a lot of that, you shift in perspective. And walking into my first grocery store in New York was straight old school hallucinogenic. Like, I couldn't believe the amount of colors. I felt overwhelmed and dizziness, but it also felt so comforting and soothing. Like, it was this birthright that I was recognizing as an American for the first time. Like, this level of abundance is something that I get. And so having those cylinders kind of click in my brain, one was the first path of the book, but it was something I couldn't see until I was away from it for a while. Just similar to the way I think people couldn't see that grocery employees are essential workers until the prospect of having to get food without a grocery store, or the fact that the 365 days per year abundance they're used to might be interrupted for all of 3 or 4 days or a week, right? That was a terrifying prospect. And that caused some cylinders in their brains to click.
One thing you learned is that the people in charge of supermarkets do not see food the way we do, at least when they're at work. How do they conceptualize all the tens of thousands of items that they sell?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's impossible for them to think of them with all the different virtues that we were just discussing, the ways they express personality. So they get distilled down to product. And in many ways, that even gets distilled further into, a line on a spreadsheet that reflects gross margin or the amount of money more that they're going to be making on this particular product than a parallel product. And that's it. At the end of the day, grocery stores are CPG, that's consumer packaged goods stores, that sell a slightly more perishable product than the rest of them. And so that mentality that the supermarket manager has as a reflex, and if you listen to them, and I spend a lot of time in grocery stores researching the book, they never talk about food. They talk about product this, product that, let's stack this product. That's how you can intervene into the system if you're looking to think about how to be an advocate for reform. Like, you have to come at it at their terms, rather than thinking about it as a purely ecological thing or purely a nutrition thing, because to them, it doesn't exist in those qualities.
The other thing that surprised me, and I guess it shouldn't have, is when they are deciding what to sell, they are not, tasting 15 kinds of bread and deciding this one is really superior. They're just figuring out what's got shelf life, what's going to move. They don't care so much about quality.
That's right. I mean, it's not that they're not tasting things at all. I just think what the misconception is that taste would be number one or number two on the list of qualities when you're thinking about stocking your grocery store. And the reality is that it's not, and it may not even be a tertiary quality. It's pretty far down the list when compared to margin and stability and shelf life and all of these factors that determine how their job performance is measured. If you're a category manager, which is the kind of the person who's making buying decisions in a large chain, the pressures you're feeling are from your boss, who wants you to grow gross margin year after year, not the pressure of the consumer who wants to taste the best yogurt out there. And so part of that might be getting a really tasty yogurt, but another part of that might be making sure that the high margin yogurt you are selling isn't outcompeted by a really tasty yogurt that doesn't have, the same margins below it. Right. So you don't want your goods cannibalizing each other. You kind of want to steer people to the right product. And so figuring out that mix is really important. Figuring out the taste. Meh.
So I guess I knew that before the modern supermarket, there were grocers and you'd walk in and say, I'd like a can of tomatoes and, you know, some flour or whatever. And somebody would get that off a shelf for you. What I didn't realize is that the convenience store is just about as old as the modern grocery store.
Yeah. Yeah. They're born in parallel, but in kind of completely different fashions. And I kind of sketched them both because they both feed into the Trader Joe's story. But the convenience store really came out of kind of the ultimate luxury in the hot Dallas, Texas heat, which was ice. And there were all these commercial ice docks long before there were ice makers. People carved up the Great Lakes of the Northeast and would ship them all over the world by packaging up big cubes of ice and sawdust. And there were retail docks that would sell these. And those retail docks really gave birth to the convenience store because some entrepreneurial manager of a regional dock got the idea that if I stay open a little later and I add some eggs and some vegetables into this ice, I can have a year-round business where to even out the summer rush. And that ice dock gradually morphed into the 7-Eleven of our day.
And the first supermarket chain, which was Piggly Wiggly, basically adapted Henry Ford's assembly line so the people moved along a conveyor belt rather than the product.
Yeah, that's right. I would say calling it the first supermarket or first grocery store is a contentious issue in this world. I have to push back. But what he did do was exactly what you said. And really not even adapting Henry Ford's assembly line. He did it a few years earlier, and it might as well be just independent discovery, or rather both of them kind of being inspired by the smorgasbord cafeteria style restaurants that were sweeping across the nation in the 1880s, where, you know, instead of having a waiter come up to your table, you would go down this cafeteria line and people would scoop things out. Now we have an unsavory thing, but that's really an assembly line. And both of them were kind of inspired by that. And so Clarence Saunders, had this idea that we're going to put customers on a path, much like a modern day IKEA, and they're going to go in front of the goods and they're going to be able to choose the goods that they want, all of which was completely new to the shopping experience. Heretofore, grocery stores operated with all the goods behind the counter. They were called a general store. They sold a wide variety of things, and they were all in a kind of anonymous bulk. So you would go with your list, and the clerk would fill it with what items they had. And there was a number of shifts that went into Clarence Saunders' thinking, but essentially he put the goods in front of people and allowed them to sift through those options, price compare, allowed them to make choices. And in that choice making, you get to that first point we kind of made, there was a lot of meaning that was created. So all of a sudden the choice to buy something cheaper was like an act of devotion to the home, or buying your kids something they were longing for was an act of showing them love, right? And that really came out of that price comparison choosing that he put front and center in his stores.
All right. So the guy that we might think of as Trader Joe is actually a real person. Is it Colombe? Joe Colombe? How do you say his name?
Joe Colum.
Okay. So he didn't start out wanting to invent a different kind of supermarket. Actually, we're about to come to a break here. So let's think about Joe Colum, and we'll come back to this in a minute, because his story is really, really interesting. And the ways that Trader Joe's started to be different than the supermarkets around them are really interesting. My guest this hour is author Benjamin Lohr. His new book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Benjamin Lohr. His new book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. All right, Ben, the ways that Trader Joe's differs from other stores may not be as obvious to us now as it was a few decades ago, because other stores have copied some of the things Trader Joe's have done. But talk about what made Joe Kalum's market different than the competitors at the time.
Yeah. And there are a lot. and I think maybe even to understand them, we got to even back up. So we talked a little bit about Clarence Saunders allowing people to touch the goods. And the next kind of big innovation that put the supermarket of today down was this guy, Michael Cullen, who decided that rather than sell on a strictly margin game, you could add volume and just sell a lot of products and then shrink your margins down really low. So he essentially just inflated Clarence Saunders' idea to it maximal proportions. And of course, his first store was like 6,000 square feet, which is basically a convenience store today. But at the time, people thought that was crazy. Housewives literally worried that they would get lost inside of it. People reported feeling faint. Now, a Costco is like 200,000 square feet. So in doing that, the store suddenly was offering far more goods. And that was the world that Joe Kalum, founder of Trader Joe's, found himself in. And he realized that that was not really a world he could compete in, that it was an unsteady top. The only way to get better and offer discounts to your clients were either by selling items at a loss, which you could only afford to do if you were a giant, or by getting so big that you could get volume discounts from vendors, and you could also only do that if you got giant. So and that was essentially the game that everyone was playing at his time, and he decided if he played that game he would probably lose, even though he's a fantastically smart guy. And so he decided he would kind of reinvent the store to focus on a specific subset of consumers that he felt was getting overlooked by this store that was kind of trying to be big for everybody and thereby serving nobody. And so he kind of looked at the retail landscape and I guess I should step back and say Joe is like a really idiosyncratic, eccentric thinker who I found quite brilliant in talking to him. But he was a very intuitive guy. And so he started drawing on these unusual sources. So like he read an article about the GI Bill. This was in 1965, I think, and how, a third generation of soldiers who are coming back from Vietnam were going to get the benefits of the GI Bill, which guaranteed them a college education. And that would expand the reach of a college education to a whole new class of consumers. And he just thought that people who went to college get a new vocabulary. He was careful to say he didn't think they were any smarter, they just had this new vocabulary, a new intellect that they wanted to flex. And he thought that they going to the typical supermarket wouldn't give them an opportunity to flex that. He also noticed that the 747, the first jumbo jet, was coming online, and that was going to decrease the cost of international travel dramatically. And in fact, he was right about that. It fell about 1/15 of the cost to go to Europe within a few years. But he thought again, okay, people who are suddenly going to Europe for the first time are going to want to eat like with the products that they see there and the experiences that they have. And this is a guy who had at this point hadn't traveled internationally. So he was making these kind of wild deductions that proved very salient. And he decided he would make a store that could serve this new consumer. And he conceptualized them as overeducated and underpaid. but people who had a lot of like worldly experience and wanted to flex that, but they didn't necessarily have the dollar, the coin to spend it on gourmet. And that's really was some of the birth material for Trader Joe's. Of course, that's easy to articulate, but really hard to execute. And so he did something else that was pretty revolutionary, which is that he slashed offerings in the store. Instead of trying to get bigger and bigger and offer more products, he offered fewer and fewer products, but empowered his buyers to really gain mastery over those supply lines. So unlike the buyers we were talking about earlier, where taste was like a third, fourth order decision, he wanted his buyers to learn enough that they could understand the complexities of the supply chain and then search for products that had the taste profiles or intellect profile, you know, like kind of tickling of the brain that he thought that underpaid consumer would enjoy. And it's almost Jobsian, Steve Jobsian, in the sense that he was kind of inventing products that he thought his consumers would want, not actually asking them what they wanted and then giving it to them. But that all came to fruition in his private label line. And if you go into Trader Joe's today, it's almost all Trader Joe's branded things. And it reflects the identity of Trader Joe's rather than a typical supermarket, which is more of a landlord that is just leasing out space to different brands. And so then has a hodgepodge of identities.
So before we move on from this, I have to say, I like Trader Joe's okay. I find that there's a lot of processed food in your average Trader Joe's, but when you go in there, somehow you feel like you're buying stuff that is good for you. How have they managed that?
Oh my God, I'm the same way. So I have to say, I walked into this book a total Trader Joe's agnostic. I'm not a fanboy. I was mostly just fascinated by the fact that some people seemed to lose their brains when they went into a Trader Joe's and would report, you know, that it was the most fantastic place on the planet. And I was like, oh, I really want to understand what's going on in this. So I think they do, you know, they create a halo, and it's a decency halo is how I refer to it in the book, which is, you know, they do shifts in the supply chain, you know, or there's certain ingredients that they try to get out, preservatives and added coloring, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's health food by any means. But they play up certain factors that really appeal to their target demographic. And then you kind of assume that a lot of the other stuff in there, because that it all falls into a similar worldview, it kind of fits into these other classes of of health. And I think also because some of these products attract people so intensely, they're really the products that they want at a price that they find reflects value. They don't really care about the fact that it's not healthy anymore because it has all these other virtues that they're excited about.
All right. You worked at a grocery store as a way of doing research for this book. You actually got a job at Whole Foods for a while. You were expected to be really excited about having this job, and that became clear to you even during the training.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was, you know, in general, as a writer, I try to get as close to the world that I'm writing about. My last book was on Bikram yoga, you know, the hot yoga, and I did gobs of yoga for that, just unending amounts of yoga, really. And so for this book, I was like, you can't write a book about the grocery store without doing some hours on the retail floor. And I had worked retail before, but this was really eyes open just for the book. Whole Foods, you know, that was part of their brand identity, I think, was to just impress upon you how privileged you were to work at the Whole Foods. And at that time, they were paying leading low-end wages. You know, we were making $11 an hour, I believe, in New York, which is not quite a livable wage in the city, but is still higher than a minimum wage. And so it was somewhat of a contested job, but they did a really good job, I would say, in quotes good, of convincing you that there was a Whole Foods team and that you needed to play on the Whole Foods team, and that there was an excitement about being on the Whole Foods team, all with this kind of unstated threat that if you ever did anything that would make them ask you to play for another team, they might have to do that because they really only wanted the super enthusiastic people working for them.
One thing you learned was that, and it's not to knock only at Whole Foods, but grocery stores Sometimes they need a whole lot of employees on the floor. Sometimes the store is not crowded. It's not always predictable what that's going to look like. And so these workers are on the schedule for a certain number of hours of every week, but then they might get cut at the last minute, which makes it really hard to get a second job if you happen to need one.
Yes, this is absolutely not something that's Whole Foods specific. And in fact, when I was working at Whole Foods, they didn't even have this practice in name. I think like that kind of pressure I was talking to about to be a team player, it would often manifest itself, even though it wasn't official policy. But yeah, this is variable scheduling or just-in-time scheduling. It is pretty insidious. I think a lot of people have blinders onto it because, like a lot of people, I worked minimum wage jobs pre-college, like in high school, college, right after college. I waited a lot of tables. I feel like I have a sense of what those jobs are like. But over the last 10 to 15 years, there have been big changes. And one of those changes is in efficiency and staffing. And so it used to be you would get your schedule a few weeks ahead of time and you would get your, you could arrange your life about it. Maybe it was only a week ahead, maybe it was 2 weeks ahead. Now, because they want to tailor staff availability to customer demand in a really tightly coupled way, in the same way that they expect tightly coupled logistics for a product being shipped to warehouses, you might get your schedule 1 to 2 days in advance. The hours might shift radically from the week before. And so hours worked jumping 40% or falling 40% week to week, which of course means take-home pay falls by that amount. And the actual slots of the schedule might change radically week to week. So all creates extreme instability where you can't plan your life, you can't plan childcare, and even fixed costs in your life become question marks because your pay is rising and falling by 40% week to week, or up to 40%. So it was quite destabilizing. And I think I at least, you know, had a halo of nostalgia. Well, these aren't good jobs, but they're jobs that you do. And it just wasn't the reality. The actual meat and bones of those jobs have changed. And of course, with growing wealth inequity, they're no longer just for high school, college, and college grads. There are people making careers at these jobs. And they're not only dealing with the low wages, but they're dealing with this instability on top of it, many of which will say the instability is worse than the low wages.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Another true miracle of grocery stores is how much fresh and perishable merchandise they always have available. We can thank the trucking industry for that in part. Trucking as a profession, though, has changed a lot in recent years. First of all, how do most people get into the business now?
Oh, yeah, trucking is fascinating. You know, if I in my head had this, like, you know, BJ and the Bear, Smokey and the Bandit, scruffy, lovable outlaw trucker, but middle class in my head. And that's just not the case anymore. Trucking suffers from enormous turnover. So, like, turnover meaning people start the job and quit the job. The yearly turnover for trucking over the last decade has ranged between 95% and 110%, right?
Wow.
So that's universal turnover, or plus more than universal turnover, which means there's a great demand for new recruits. So to answer your question, they are recruiting people rapaciously from wherever, and often they're coming in from other minimum wage jobs. I would hear stories from recruiters, and I would hear stories from truckers of people who are getting recruited out of soup kitchens, homeless shelters, but really people who needed a new life and then were going to be offered this lifeline of trucking as an opportunity for them. And of course, once they found out the realities of that job, often it did not match the kind of pitch that they were given.
Yeah, you spent a lot of time with a woman named Lynn who takes in a pretty large amount of money every year and takes home so little money that she actually doesn't have a home. She lives in her truck.
That's right. Trucking is a brilliant example of kind of how, like, theoretical concepts like deregulation, which often benefit us as consumers quite a bit, can have enormous consequences on the labor force. So as I was, you know, discussing, not only did that turnover happen, causing like rapacious new recruits, to get into trucking, you need to get a commercials driver's license, a CDL license, which costs money. And then you need to have a truck, which also costs money. And the companies are all too happy to offer credit on both those things in the form of student loans and or a lease owner operator agreement. The problem is that then you're beholden by debt to these companies and you can't operate on a free market. You're just taking loads from them and they can wield that debt as a threat and actually starve you out if you kind of complain or rebel or look for other options by cutting your miles down, and you have a contractual obligation because of that debt to only work through them. It also, you know, a lot of the truckers I was talking to when I was driving around with the woman I call in would refer to it as sharecropping on wheels or a debt peonage because they felt so beholden to the companies through the debt that they had taken out. And in Lynn's case, what would happen, you know, she would make a great deal of money, but there were mandatory deductions on her paycheck for not just the debt, but for fixed costs that she wasn't able to negotiate out of because they came from her carrier, and they would whittle down her paycheck so that the week that I was with her, she only took home $100 for working 70-hour work week. And that was true for the week before. She would say, I've learned how to stretch $100. But I think for many of us and your listeners, the idea that you could work 70 hours in a week in a state of constant vigilance, truck driving is a hard job, and then walk home with $100 is kind of mind blowing.
My guest is author Benjamin Lohr. His book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. We'll be right back. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Benjamin Lohr. His new book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Ben, one of the things that has changed a lot at grocery stores is the affordability of certain kinds of products. And we know that, you know, at all times there are Americans who struggle to buy food. It's particularly rough at the moment when a lot of people are not working. But certain things that used to be like once a year treats, even for, or once a month, even for employed families, are now pretty affordable. You spent some time with shrimpers in Thailand, and I wonder if you can talk to us about the working conditions you observed.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying is that is why it's a miracle. It's, you know, the subtitle is not for nothing here. It's the dark miracle of the American supermarket. We used to spend 40% of our income on food, 100 years ago. Now we're spending less than 10%. And all across the chain, the prices, consumer prices are going down. And very much all of the practices that we've been talking about, from variable scheduling to cheap freight and trucking, drive those low prices. They just come with dark consequences. And I think nowhere did I see that more than in Thailand. So I spent a lot of time in the Thai seafood sector because it really represented a place where I could kind of sift through the lines of the supply chain to get close to the bottom of it and talk to people. I spent some time with Burmese migrants who had been trafficked and then essentially kidnapped or enslaved. They were abducted against their will and put on boats that then would be out at sea sometimes for 6 months to sometimes upwards of a year, and they would get resupplied out there. So kind of these floating prisons. They would get beaten if they didn't work. The fisher that I spoke with for the book and kind of focus on watched his best friend get murdered on the boat. Really horrific conditions. And what they were essentially doing, I mean, they were getting seafood of all different types. In the book, I made the connection that some of the seafood they were getting was trashed fish, which is essentially unsaleable small fish that used to get dumped right off the side of the boat. They would come up in these big benthic trawl nets that are kind of scraping the bottom of the ocean. But now these trash fish can get turned into fish meal, which is the protein base of aquaculture. So farmed salmon and shrimp, you know, all of these, even though they're farmed, you might think, oh, we don't need much wild caught stuff, but these are carnivorous species. They still use protein. They still need the like omega-3 fats from the ocean in the case of salmon. So they still need that wild caught food at the bottom of the chain. And we as our national appetite for these has increased, and as the kind of forces of commodity have worked on them so that their prices has fallen, the volume of this has changed enormously over the last 40 years, which puts a huge pressure on these kind of like natural resources. And the problem, I should say problem, but it's kind of problem in quotes, the fact, I guess, of the Thai seafood industry is that it's full of very small holder fishermen. So there's 10,000 of these boats out there, and many, most, in fact, we can say are good actors who are doing things just right. But there are also a lot of bad actors who are doing the types of things that I observed in the book. And those get mixed into this chain because of the sheer volume of the system. It's you know, it's easy to sit back in America and say, like, oh, well, let's only buy from the places that don't use slave labor. But it's a lack of understanding just how complex the supply chain is to get that volume, and how many different fishermen you're using as inputs, and how you gather those inputs and aggregate them at various stages on the chain, and how they can kind of be, you know, to use mafia language, like laundered in with the good products. It's actually extremely hard to disentangle. And so you have NGOs who are working in the sector who will say, you know, they are just beginning to learn the ways of refining, reforming a supply chain.
A lot of people now look for food that is certified, organic, or sustainable, or fair trade. Are we avoiding real harm by doing this? Are we getting, if we're paying a little extra, are we ensuring that this is a little better for the environment or for the people who are involved in producing this food?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I think the answer is we're mostly paying for a sense of satisfaction and absolution, moral absolution. The sad truth is the mechanisms that undergird a lot of these certifications, from rainforest friendly to fair trade, are audits. And so you have a team of auditors who go to a manufacturing plant and they go check out the books. This provides a snapshot of that for one day. It doesn't have any enforcement teeth. For non-empirical things like labor abuse, it's almost impossible in a globalized world where people are speaking different languages and workers are working under threats to their health. They're not going to speak out to auditors and risk their jobs. So it provides a real false sense, a false picture, especially for things in the ethical sphere. I sadly came to realize, because I am someone who ponies up for the ethical, and I still do, because I think it's probably better than nothing, but it is absolutely unsatisfactory in terms of connecting our good intentions at checkout to measurable results on the other side.
All right, let's go to the phone. We have Robert on the line in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you very much for the conversation. I just wanted to input a few things on the conversation. I'm a truck driver. I've been doing it for 20 years. I drive a refrigerated vehicle, which is mostly grocery. And some of the warehouses that we go into, we have to deliver anytime, day or night. So we do night driving, we do day driving, and there's a lot of switchback in between, and it's not an easy business. And some of these warehouses you see are just absolutely huge. They take in hundreds of trucks a day, you know, and it's just, I've been out here even through the pandemic. I haven't been home since December. And it's just, it's a hard life. It really is.
Well,
not an easy one.
Thank you
but
for
I do
calling.
Make a good living.
You do. So, excuse me, before I let you go, Robert, and I will say thank you for your work, because it is essential work, and we've never really understood that as well as we do now. Do you own your own rig at this point?
I do lease from a company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after expenses, I still make a good living. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the money I do take in goes for expenses, fuel, insurance, of that sort.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. It sounds like some of what you saw happening. I'm glad to know that Robert's able to make a decent living, Ben. But is there anything there that you want to comment on?
Oh, well, no. I mean, I'm really appreciative that he called in, because I think that is one of the big messages of the book, is just forget labor abuse. The life of a trucker is enormously difficult, and there are a lot of obstacles. Like, there's a lot of labor that gets left on the table. What he was talking about with those big warehousing centers, a lot of those don't respect the trucker's time. So they have appointments that are basically make or break for them. If they miss it, that's their docked big time. And for the warehousing or distribution center, they kind of can ignore them. And the trucker's not getting paid at that point. They've delivered their load. And they're just sitting around in these kind of gray sectors of the labor market, unpaid, often, like Robert was saying, at ungodly hours of the night, 4 a.m, sitting around at a distribution center where you're forced to be awake because you have to be on call, but you're not getting paid for being on call because the load is technically over and you're just waiting for someone else to do their part. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. If you're an owner operator, you're responsible for all your repairs on your rig, and driving a truck is a whole different ball of wax from driving a Honda sedan. You're logging 12,000 miles regularly. The repairs ramp up to that. And so it is a brutal lifestyle. And the time away from family is brutal. So I really appreciate him making those points. And I'm glad that he's scraping out a meaningful living. I think you can do that once you get experience. The problem with trucking is so often it preys on these new recruits who don't know what they're doing. And they're the ones who can really be exploited easily.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Something else I had not really thought much about before was how new products get into grocery stores if they're not, like, you know, designed by Kraft or some mega corporation. You talked to a woman who made, what is it, salsa coleslaw?
Slossa.
Slossa.
The condiment that'll change your life. It's a coleslaw salsa combination. And she was trying to get this onto shelves of grocery stores, and she was doing so successfully, but I was blown away by the number of obstacles in her path. I kind of thought in the back of my head, okay, you know, you get your thing, you put it in a jar, you get it onto a shelf. If people like it, then you'll make some money. And the reality is that there are a number of hurdles that are pretty invisible. Number one of which is that the way the supermarket makes its money is not necessarily on your margins, like we were talking about earlier back in the old days, but also from direct payments that you're making to the store for shelf space. These are called slotting fees. It's very much a pay-to-play system, which I had no idea about. I think maybe I knew that end caps, those big kind of festive displays at the end that gets your eye, were pay to play. But I'm just talking about inches on shelf anywhere, which in some national distributors can be as high as $55,000 a month for 12 by 22 inches of shelf space. So these are real huge costs. Which then, of course, cause a small entrepreneur like the woman that I was following with a genuinely tasty product to have to take on exponentially more risk than she would otherwise. You can't grow the business slowly either. You have to pay those fees, which Julie in the book does not. She chooses not to do that, or attach to venture capital. And it's kind of a squeeze play. So you either remain very small, grinding it out, or you get really big and take these huge risks.
Did working on this book make you realize how much your taste in food has been influenced by people who are not you, by sort of market forces, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I haven't been asked before, but yes, one of the interests I read something by an anthropologist in this book who was studying like how people make purchasing decisions. And one of the really interesting things he said, he was studying actually clothing purchasing options and people in Britain and in Trinidad. And he realized they didn't know whether or not they liked something when they were buying it and trying it on. They only realized that they liked it after someone else told them that they liked it on them. And this was like this very counterintuitive truth that I was like, no, that's not true for me. Like, I know whether I like something when I buy it, that I've slowly realized is actually true for me. I just don't want to admit it. And that we have these very socially constructed identities and tastes that do echo back other people's preferences. And that's it goes into understanding the entire giant retail reflection that is the grocery store.
Can you give us just one quick thought for those of us fortunate enough to be in a position to try and make ethical decisions at the grocery store? Is there one thing we can do to try and buy products that don't harm people just by virtue of their existence?
I would reject that idea. I think, look, support policies on a government level that create trade treaties so that we don't globalize labor standards that are below average, right? If we're going to have global trade, we need global standards for the workers. We need unions or union equivalents that allow workers to self-advocate and get heard in meaningful ways. Like, we've seen a real destruction of the labor market. Like, I think this idea that we're going to make purchasing decisions that are going to make the world better is extremely self-serving and therefore it's hypnotic. And I fall victim to this myself. I mean, I want to believe that if I buy the right tomato sauce that tastes delicious, that I'm also going to cure global hunger and stop deforestation. But if you stop to think about it, it's crazy. Like, we need enforcement of against bad actors, which is police action probably, trade action. And we need to strengthen workers' rights.
I got to jump in here. My guest is Benjamin Lohr. His book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Ben, thanks for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.